Good morning. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and my guest is Jeff Kohler, author of Darjeeling, The Colorful History and Precarious Fate of the World's Greatest Tea. Jeff Kohler is a writer, traveler, cook, and author of books and articles on food and culture, including the cookbooks Spain and Morocco. Jeff, welcome to KBOO. Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
And I should say that Jeff will be reading tonight at Powell's Books. That's at 7:30. You can hear more about this, and I guess you'll be talking about it also, as well as reading.
Yes. Yeah, and I'll be giving a PowerPoint. So there'll be lots of images, because it's so visual, the area, the process. So I'll be showing some images while I discuss the book.
And the book does have a center section with many photos of the area and mm-hmm. people working to pick the tea and various historical aspects. So that is part of it that really helped me understand what things were like there.
Yes, I mean, I was shooting a lot of images. In the book, there are all my images. I was shooting a lot while I was up there. Part is a visual notebook. I mean, as a researching any project, it just helps to later to look at those and you see again the images. You remember things that maybe you didn't catch the first time. But I spent a couple of months up there, and by the end, I was taking, you know, my best photographic gear. I realized how visual and how beautiful it is. It's so many greens, for instance, just the endless shades of greens on these tea-covered hillsides, and the whole process, specifically of the workers plucking and then working in the factories, is really, really visual and really, really beautiful. And so I shot a lot. I shot thousands and thousands of images. So in the end of the book, there's a couple of maybe three dozen, but it was difficult to narrow them down because it's so lovely up there.
Mm-hmm. So why did you want to write about Darjeeling tea?
I first visited Darjeeling about 20 years ago, and I'd been traveling quite a bit. It was after university. I went to Gonzaga up in Spokane, and I spent about 4 years traveling around in the end. It didn't start out to be 4 years, but it became 4 years. And in those years, I lived on tea. I really drank endless cups of tea. And my memories of I think about those years, is of tea. But usually it's sweet and milky and often spiced. And when I got to Darjeeling, I've been on the road maybe 2 years, I tasted tea for the first time. Tea meaning just tea, no milk, no sugar, no lemon, no cardamom, no ginger. And it tasted just as fresh as those hills, I was saying. Outside Darjeeling, which is about 7,000 feet up in the northeast Himalaya, kind of wedged up between Nepal on one side and Sikkim and then Tibet to the north and then Bhutan on the other side. The tea was really fresh. And this about 20 years ago, this began an obsession with the tea, but also the whole culture around the tea and the industry and the area and the people. And I traveled to India quite a few times, and it was an idea that I always wanted to, you know, I know that writing a book means a couple of years immersing myself in the topic. And so after four cookbooks, I really wanted to change the style of book. And Darjeeling has all the elements of a great story. It's almost a blockbuster of why it's there, how it got there, and the tea itself. All these elements came together so that I was able to, either my obsession formed into that, or it kind of allowed for my obsession to kind of blossom for a couple of years and really spend, you know, two solid years really living or drinking, I should say, Darjeeling and its history and learning everything I could about it.
Right. And the history is one of the things I wanted to talk about. The aspect of Darjeeling tea that is it native to the Darjeeling region? That's sort of something that's
not
surprising.
The tea in Darjeeling was originally from China. Now, India developed a really successful industry of tea in Assam, in the lower in the northeast. They found a tea growing native to it, Assamic tea. But it makes a brisker tea, a stronger tea, and the English at that time who were in India, they still wanted that quality of tea that they were getting out of China. And so the only way they could really get that was to send somebody to smuggle out not only the tea plants and the seeds and actually somehow get them, we're talking 1840s here, back to India to the botanical garden and to the to the experimental gardens, but the knowledge. And a Scotsman called Robert Fortune, his true name, went for 3 years, and he, by his own estimate, was able to get out 22,000 tea plants to experimental gardens in India, and some of those made it to Darjeeling. And tea, Darjeeling was never established as a place to plant tea, nor even the tourist resort that is today. It was a sanitarium. It was for East Indian Company soldiers to go and recuperate. And the first superintendent of Darjeeling was the first one to plant tea in his garden there. And it took off. And it found its perfect home in Darjeeling. And so, no, it's not from there, but it's the ideal climate, the ideal soil, the weather. Everything is about as perfect to make this extremely good tea.
And you mentioned the East India Company. Can you talk a little bit about the role of that company in this whole history of Darjeeling tea?
Well, the English were drinking a lot of tea, were importing a lot of tea. So in 1800, something like 25 million pounds of tea they're importing. And the East India Company had a complete monopoly on importing it. But it wasn't coming out of any of the colonies or any of the territories that Britain was ruling. It was all coming from China. And China at that time was not interested in Wedgwood plates or clocks. They had to pay them for the tea in silver. And this was creating a big drain on the treasury in London. And so they needed something that the Chinese would want to buy or to trade. And they found that essentially in opium. And they were producing opium in India, in the Ganges, and they would come down and they would auction it in Calcutta, and then it would be sent on to China. And this, of course, is one of the causes of the opium wars when the Chinese tried to stop the import of the opium. But it was kind of not exactly bartered, but it was for the English good because they weren't having to bring vast amounts of silver across the sea to buy the tea. They were essentially bringing in the opium with that money then paying for the tea. But this, there was some fear of the source, and this is one of the reasons why they developed a tea industry. First, they started looking for a place to plant tea, but then they actually discovered in northeast Indian Assam by the Burmese border this local variety. And tea was, for the East Indian Company, was their most profitable product. I mean, for sure, when they're importing it. And then opium became also. But these were, one of the drives for the English in India was tea.
Right. You say that somewhere in the book that the history of tea starts the history of tea in India is totally tied to the empire and the history of the British in India. There's some
well, it was such an important product. I mean, they brought in so much tea. I mean, there's an unbelievable amount of tea, and it was even for merchants in London. You know, it was the most profitable product. You know, that they really. While tea is native of Asia and in China and in Japan, there's great traditions of tea. For the English also is culturally is an incredibly important drink. I mean, it's a cliche, but, you know, the English drinking tea, but they really drank a lot of tea. I mean, it phenomenal amounts of tea that were being consumed in the early coffee houses. And of course, in the beginning, it was for health, you know, and all these great, the early advertisements for the tea about, you know, they're pretty funny about what they do, you know, for the spleen or whatever, but of course, they always talk about the male virility, you know, just it did everything somehow, the tea. And it was a great product. And for sure was one of the, and it's one of the lasting legacies of the British in India also, because India has the world's, it produces the second largest amount of tea in the world. It used to be first, it was overtaken not long ago by China, but they produce almost, well, over 2 billion pounds of tea a year in India.
And what was the role of the Indian people as these estates developed, particularly in Darjeeling? Were the Indian people, were the workers? Were there any Indian people who were...
There weren't many managers on the tea estates in Darjeeling that were Indian early on. And the workers, neither, actually. They were... The area of Darjeeling was pretty isolated and pretty rural, and the local indigenous people weren't that interested in helping the English develop the tea industry, but there wasn't also so many. So they brought in ethnic Gorkhas from Nepal just across the border to work on the estates, to establish them and to work. And even today, Darjeeling district has a population of about 1.8 million. something like 80% of maybe are ethnic Gorkhas. It's the largest ethnic group coming out of Nepal, and they were settled specifically to work on the tea estates.
And what do the what does a tea worker do?
Today, well, the most visible ones you see are the tea pluckers, and these are all women.
Why are they all women?
If you ask them, the answer you get from the manager is always they have the most delicate fingers, and they're the best ones to be able to selectively pluck. Because a Darjeeling tea is manual. There's nothing automated about it. The entire system is completely hands-on. The Darjeeling tea bush is plucked one bush about every 6 to 8 days. And they're only taking the two fresh leaves and the terminal bud. It's very highly selective plucking. And it takes 10,000 of these plucks to make a single kilo of Darjeeling tea. It's really, really laborious. So the answer is they'll say, well, only women are the ones who can really get in and get the leaves. But this is what they say, but the tradition is that the men tend to do a bit heavier, the pruning, a bit more heavier farm work. And they also work in what they call the factory. Factory is a misleading term, like a big airy barn. But you see lots of men doing working the rolling machine. They tend to work inside the factory. In the factory, the only women that you see really working are the ones that are doing the sorting. And a lot of it's sorted by hand when you get different types of leaf grade. And this is for exactly the same reason. If you ask them, they all say, well, it's because women have the most delicate fingers and the lightest touch, and they're the best ones to sort.
And those are two of the aspects of the whole process of producing tea. I think you say the plucking, and then about that.
Yeah, it takes about 20 to 24 hours for tea to go from being on the bush to being ready to be put in your cup to make a cup of tea. And it's plucked, and the women pluckers, they carry a basket on their back when they kind of a strap across their forehead, traditional one. They dump their basket like twice a day. The leaves immediately go to the factory, as it's called. And the factory at the second floor, the top level, is what they call the withering beds. So the leaves immediately get taken to wither. They wither overnight, and that means they lose about 66% or so of their moisture. They wilt. So by the morning time, they're shrunken up. So they have these long withering beds, and they put the leaves about, say, 8 inches deep. A kind of long, 30, 40, 50 feet long beds. But by the morning time, it's only an inch or two deep. And they're ready, they're pliable, they're ready to be rolled. So the next step is rolling. So they roll the leaves, and this, you start to get the shape of a tea leaf, what we would think is a tea leaf in a teacup. But as important or more important is that it begins the oxidation or the fermentation process by rupturing the cells, the juices exposed to the oxygen, and begins to oxidize. The leaves then go to these what they call fermentation beds, and this is the step of the process where the teas take on the color, gets those the tannins, the attributes to the cup of tea you think, the aroma, the strength. These characteristics develop on the fermentation bed, and it sits on these beds anywhere from half an hour to 4 hours, depending on the season. And it's a magic here. It comes off the roller, it's kind of warm, it's still kind of a greenish color, and it, over the hours it kind of turns brownish and becomes something very different to warm. And the most important person in the factory, arguably, is the person who says, yes, the leaves are ready to be fired. Because after the fermentation process, when they think that the flavor and the aroma and everything is just right, they need to go right to the big oven and is sealing those flavors. So you have two noses, as they say, that the flavors and the fermentation beds go up a little bit, they drop down slightly, and then they go up again and they fall off completely. And you need to catch the top of the second nose, they say. And the only way to tell this is to by smelling it. And so they're going through and they're smelling the fermenting leaves every couple of minutes at the end. And the person who makes that call says, okay, now it's ready, immediately goes off to the oven. And this, as I said, these people are bloodhounds. I mean, they have incredible olfactory abilities to be able to know precisely when the tea is going to be at its peak. Because it's not like it suddenly smells a lot and then it doesn't smell. It's really, really nuanced. But of course, after years and years. So I read about in the book one gentleman on Makabari, the most famous estate, and he's been there. He was born on the estate. His parents worked on the estate, and he's been in charge of this for 40 some years. He's not a trained agronomist, whatever. He's just this incredible natural ability of smell and even taste when he tastes the cup. And just phenomenally, but that's what they do every day, because the leaves are changing from mid-March to mid-November. It's not identical every day. The weather changing, the leaf is changing, the weather changing. So every single day, that process changes a little bit. Yeah. And so it's this incredible years of skill, as well as combined with this natural ability to be able to identify smells. We all smell, but to be able to vocalize and to identify things is, for me, is incredible to be with these people when they're tasting tea and they're smelling and what they can pick out, and they can identify, yeah, this is from this particular part of the farm, or it's really amazing.
It sounds almost like wine tasting.
It is. When you taste a cup of tea, I mean, for me, when I, started looking, I thought this is much more difficult than wine tasting, because when you're tasting teas, you're tasting teas every morning after they come out of the dryer. They taste every batch side by side. And you're tasting really for tomorrow, because say you're going to ferment for 3 hours and a half today. Well, tomorrow you kind of start there, but maybe tomorrow it's a little bit warmer, so you're going to have a little bit shorter. So you're gauging the taste for tomorrow. But with this, you're looking at the dry leaf. You're looking at the infused leaf. It's called the infusion. And then you're tasting the tea, though, but you need to taste it warm, but you need to taste it as it cools, because there's volatile flavors and aromas, and there's fixed flavors and aromas, and you want the ones that are fixed also. So you're tasting many times, and you're tasting every day, so the harvest changes a little bit every single day over the course of those months. So I met people, Robert Parker famously tastes, say, 10,000 bottles of wine a year, and he's the expert for sure globally. I met tea tasters who were tasting 1,200 teas in a week, or specifically in a day and a half. One of the auction guys I write about, the auctioneer in Calcutta, he's tasting, thousands, more than 10,000 of just the beginning, in a handful of weeks. It's just a really incredible process, because it's very, very, very important part of the process of tasting. Again, it's just adapting a little bit for the next day, and then later gauging, this is a little bit better tea than this one. Mm-hmm. Because these are organic, and they're not industrial. I mean, they're living things. It's alive. They're changing. I mean, one cup of tea next to the other, they're harvested, they're plucked the same day, harvested the same day. Everything about it is very similar, but they come from a little bit different part of the garden, completely different tasting, and...
Yes, and let me just interrupt for a minute and let people know that I am speaking with Jeff Kohler, whose new book is Darjeeling. It's The Colorful History and Precarious Fate of the World's Greatest Tea. He will be talking about that tonight at Powell's Books at 7:30. And I wanted to ask you about the term flush, which is a kind of a transitional element in your book. You have...
The book is divided into four parts by the four flushes. Originally, I wanted the title to be somehow, the history of the world's greatest tea in four flushes. But that, of course, was nixed immediately by the... by the marketing department. But the book is still divided into four flushes. A flush is very distinct, very unique for Darjeeling. The harvesting year, as I've been saying, changes a little bit every single day. But within that, you have four distinctive periods. You have the first flush, as I call it, so that the tea plant is hibernating over the winter. You get the first rains, and then you have the first flushing of the bush. And they're taking, as I said, only the new leaves and the little bud. So that the first flush, it makes a tea that's kind of quite green in the cup. It's a real greenish, bright yellow. It's light, it's bright, it's a little bit brisk. There's a slight astringency to kind of stimulate the palate. But it's a springy tea. It's a real green, it's not a green tea, it's a greenish tea. And then the weather, so this is in mid and late February into mid-April, but it starts petering out in March. In May, the weather starts getting better, and you start moving into second flush. Now, the leaves get bigger, the tea gets a little bit stronger. The classic Darjeeling flavors are more accentuated. So Darjeeling tea is famous for being kind of metallically bright. So where the first flush is a bright yellow, the second flush almost turning a little bit kind of goldish and deeper color. And the flavors, you get the classic muscatel flavor, which is kind of a musky spice with some sweet overtones, and usually how they describe it. Darjeeling tea is fruity, naturally fruity, floral, but more stem than petal, as I say in the book. It's that fruitiness, and it's stronger. So second flush for connoisseurs of Darjeeling tea, second flush is considered the best. And then in July, the rains begin. Right now is the monsoon season, raining like crazy, and monsoon flush is all about quantity. So more than half of the tea leaves of the whole harvest comes out in the monsoon flush. But this is a blender's tea. You don't see monsoon flush sold on its own, where you'd see first flush and second flush. The monsoon flush, it's the most romantic. You would think if you had a business here, monsoon flush, you think, and it's a really beautiful time of year there. But it's too hard to control the fermentation process. The withing is very hard to do with such high humidity because it's raining a lot. I mean, they get in July 30, even 40 inches of rain a month, a lot of rain. And then you have the final autumn flush, and it's the short kind of last hurrah of the bushes. And it's kind of a bit more complex. It's kind of it has a little bit of spark to it. It's a really interesting tea that you rarely get in Europe or in North America, because by that time of year, we're talking in November usually, end of October, the buyers are looking at Christmas time, and it tends to be neglected. And this is, I say, this is a delicious irony for some of the tea people in India, in Calcutta specifically, that I know, and in Delhi. They love this flush, many people do, but it's the one that, it's not cheap because it's a very limited amount. So often last year's auction, it was the highest tea of the year was an autumn flush. But for them, it's quite a good value tea because the first flush tends to be whisked off, air freighted to Europe, who buys 60% probably of Darjeeling tea. Second flush comes a bit later, but it's kind of higher prices. The autumn flush is kind of, but it's a really great, great tea. So these are the four flushers. There's not a cutoff date because it's kind of a daisy chain of these harvests. And some of the gardens, there's thousands of feet of elevation difference from the bottom to the top. And so you'll get the top will still be in first flush, and lower with a little bit warmer is already moving into second flush. So it's not, there's no definition. They say to you, yeah, now we're moving into second flush. Okay, now we're peak second flush. And kind of, they can tell. People in the gardens can tell. And again, this is from garden to garden because there's 87 tea estates in Darjeeling in seven valleys. They're small, and there's only, you know, but each is very unique. Right. Is that like the wineries? They each have their own profiles. The microclimates are you know, depends on the shade, depends on the sun, how they're processing it. It's all varies from estate to estate. And you see it in the flushes. And some estates will do a great first flushes, and maybe their second flushes will do less well on the market, mm-hmm. or vice versa.
I want to make sure we talk about the future of Darjeeling tea, because the book does include in the subtitle, you do include the word precarious fate of the world's greatest tea. And what are the factors that are making the fate of Darjeeling tea precarious?
Well, the future is really, I was amazed to see the challenges it's facing, and the numbers are really down this year. They're not even going to reach 8 million kilos of tea, which when India produces a billion kilos, and Darjeeling is doing 8 million, it's minor, but the numbers are shrinking. The climate, it starts every year, starts in a drought, and then the rains come, and the rainfall is about the same all year round, but is reduced into now a much shorter period of time. Week before last, there were some massive landslides in some of the tea gardens because it just saturates the soil. Hail. The second factor is this the ethnic Gorkhas are fighting for independent statehood within West Bengal. They don't want to be outside of India, but Calcutta, the capital of West Bengal, is 400 miles away. They don't feel ethnically, culturally, linguistically connected to what West Bengal is. And this is nothing new, but it kind of flares up, and it flared up recently, trying to get their own state. The biggest issue, though, was labor. Absenteeism on the garden this last year was 30% to 40%. And this has to do a little bit with how or why the gardens are set up. They're isolated. And when the English set up the gardens, they brought people out, moved them to the gardens and paid them, but also gave them rations. And so this isolation means that it's hard to bring in the labor. They live on the estate. Suddenly in the last couple of years, people don't want to pluck tea anymore. And this is a global trend in agriculture, but Darjeeling is even more severe because, one, education is so important in India now. And on the tea estate, education, the previous generation often were uneducated. The new generation are educated, and this is, of course, a stepping stone to something else. And combined with TV, now TV, again, they were on the estate, the isolated estates, past generations, often they saw very little outside of life on the estate. TV now, they see the rest of the world. They see what else is out there, and they compare themselves to that. So if you combined education and TV, you get aspiration. And you're seeing the aspiration of the young people. They want to do something more than their parents. But even more so, the parents want their kids to do more than them. And so even people are telling me, yeah, even if you pay, you know, even if pay was 2 times, 5 times, 10 times more than it is now, I don't want my child to pluck tea. I want them to be a teacher, to be a civil servant, to do something, a different kind of job. And so the tea garden, the managers will tell you, yes, we know where they're going and we know why they're going, but we don't know what to do.
And one of the, we just have a couple minutes left, but one of the options, one of the areas that you write about as possible futures is something from southern India in the tea industry where there is actually a worker-owned company.
Mm-hmm. There is. There was a very big estate that was failing and it was owned by a big multinational and they sold it off to the 12,700 employees who became shareholders, actually bought into it. Not just a co-op where they, you know, work, but they are on every level of it. And this has been enormously successful in the South. It's called KDHP. And they great teas, but it's much bigger than Darjeeling. I mean, they're producing about 23 million kilos of tea a year compared to Darjeeling's 8 million. So it's a much bigger estate, much bigger numbers. But as one planter told me, you know, you can't be fighting over pennies when pounds are at stake. That any changes to try to stop this labor issue, because the reality is that Darjeeling tea is phenomenal. But if you can't get the leaf off the tree, it's all irrelevant how good a tea you make. So they have to do something. And like you said, we have to make bold. We just can't adjust a little bit here, a little bit, pay a little bit more. We have to make radical changes. And it seems to be, nobody's decided exactly on how you could, which radical changes you could do or how. I think that for me personally, the KDHP model seemed to be the most viable. But when you have 87 small estates, it's very different because the average estate is only producing 200,000 kilos of tea, very small amounts of tea. So it's not as easy. The other thing is you have living on the estate, you have about 600 employees, but you have often 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 people living on the estate itself off of 225,000 kilos of tea. It's because they settle them and then you have these extended families and multi-generations. So it's also a different setup. You have to do, there's a, you know, 70-80% of the population of Darjeeling is directly or indirectly supported by the tea industry. It's a very complicated issue because of the sheer numbers involved.
Yes. And we just have a minute left, but your final thoughts on your hopes for Darjeeling tea.
I am optimistic. The passion involved, even if these estates are privately owned, losing money. Sometimes I have a couple of estates in Assam, and that's kind of supporting the Darjeeling one. But people, Darjeeling is so special. It's such an incredible heritage, if you want to call it that, product in India. There's so much pride in it, and it's such an incredible product. And they have the best raw materials for tea in the world, and many other factors involved, but it just, even for all the problems, the optimism reigns for sure.
Jeff Kohler, I want to thank you so much for coming in, and I appreciate your enthusiasm, and we just touched the surface of all the issues in this book. This has been Between the Covers, I'm Kathleen Stevenson. My guest is writer, traveler, and cook Jeff Kohler. His new book is Darjeeling. He will be talking about it tonight at Powell's Books at 7:30. If you missed part of this interview or want to hear it again, you can go to kboo.fm/betweenthecovers. The audio should be available within the next half hour or so. And stay tuned for the film show with a focus on drive-in and bike-in movies. Thank you, Jeff.
No, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizzas, salads, and wraps, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503 23